welcome to episode 5 of Shallow Die with me, Murray.
And me, Alex.
It'll be another week of cool, calm, measured analysis in this panicking world over the coronavirus pandemic. Alex, how are you feeling? Any symptoms?
I'm feeling good so far, you know, but it takes a while to kick in, so who knows?
Yeah.
Probably already infected you.
Yes, well, we're in quite close quarters this week. We're in a smaller booth. We got kicked out of our normal, nice, large studio.
It's a progressively smaller studio each week, so next week we'll probably be sort of tucked in a cupboard somewhere. Who knows?
Some so-called students were having a so-called assessment, and I wasn't allowed to be in the room, which I didn't know. So I apologise to all those students who I disturbed.
I'm sure they're all listening. Happy birthday to the Labour Party. 120 years old today. We're very happy for you. Never looked more youthful.
Yeah, very young membership, yeah, that's true.
Just hope somebody baked you a cake.
So they were founded in 1900.
Yes, exactly. The Labour Representation Committee.
Oh yeah, that's and that evolved very neat and tidy.
Yeah, evolved into the Labour Party formally 6 years later in 1906. But
I think Bernie's 120th must be coming up soon.
Pretty much, I think. Yeah.
Two titans of socialism.
Two aging dinosaurs.
Yeah, one's doing much better than the other, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, on that note,
should we dive straight in?
I think we should. We should shallow dive straight in.
Let's go. Okay, so our first segment this week is on India, because British politics is just really boring at the moment.
Agreed.
So this week saw President Trump's visit to India, which has thrown a global spotlight once again on the protests that have been happening over a recent law which has been accused of being discriminatory towards Muslims in India. Coinciding with Trump's visit, there's been a rash of violence in Delhi, the capital. I think, was it 32?
Is the current death toll, yeah.
Yeah.
At the time of recording.
And the protests seem only to be ongoing. So it's a massive problem for Narendra Modi's government, which has hitherto been doing fairly well. So the violence has been centred on Muslim-majority neighbourhoods in northeast Delhi and has kind of pitted the minority Muslim population against the majority Hindu population. And it's kind of tied into a broader trend, hasn't it, Murray?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the BJP first elected with Modi to national government in 2014. And since then, they've been following an agenda of Hindu nationalism. And so this kind of nativist agenda where almost a theocratic democratic state is trying to be formed, where the Hindu majority are seen as first-class citizens and any other religious sect, particularly Muslim communities, are becoming secondary. And Modi has a bit of a history with this. Prior to him being prime minister, he was the head of the state of...
I don't know.
Get back to you on that one. he was the premier of this state, and he essentially sanctioned mass violence against the Muslim population there, which led to about 1,000 deaths. And back in 2002, the UK actually didn't grant him a visa to come to the UK because he was seen as culpable in that. Mm. And now he's... 12 years later, he's the Prime Minister.
And that now, of course, India is returning the favour with the... there was a group of MPs who were critical of India's policy who weren't allowed entrance into the country.
Oh, yeah.
The other week, did you see?
No, I hadn't seen that.
Yeah, so they're striking back all these years later.
So back to this idea of this nationalist agenda. I think this most recent policy is the...
The immediate trigger has been the Citizenship Amendment Act, which became law in December 2019. And the CAA is a major reform of refugee law in India, essentially. So it grants sanctuary to asylum seekers fleeing religious persecution from three neighbouring countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan and Bangladesh. But it lists this sort of whole array of religions which are included, and this list specifically excludes Muslims. So it's... On the one hand, it's sort of a major liberalisation of refugee law in India, which had hitherto been extremely strict on who was allowed to enter. But on the other hand, it's that aspect of it has been almost entirely ignored because it's been seen as explicitly excluding Muslims. And that's...
But what are the real practical consequences for Muslims of this?
I think... Well, combined with everything else that the Modi government was doing, it was essentially the straw that broke the camel's back, I think. and has sort of become symbolic of the government broadly moving against Muslims, attempting to delegitimize Muslim citizenship and sort of part of a broader culture war against Muslims, making them feel unwelcome in the country.
Yeah, but there is the practical thing of a large number of Muslims, probably in the millions, would struggle to be able to be registered on this system.
Yeah, so that's and a separate law.
Yeah. But that's just part of the systemic thing, right?
Simultaneous to this, there has also, over the last few years, been the rolling out of this national register of citizens, which is basically an attempt to create a comprehensive list of all legal citizens in India.
Yeah.
But for several years, it's been rolled out in the eastern state of Assam. And over the last few months, India has announced that it's going to start rolling it out across India nationally as well. And the issue is that there may be many, many Muslims in eastern India, especially near the border with Bangladesh, who are legal citizens but have no way of proving it, so might be summarily deported into Bangladesh.
Yeah, could be deported, and also may not be able to access any kind of social services, you know, things like bank accounts, transport cards, you know, especially with the economy becoming more digitized. There was a big thing of getting rid of lots of old cash a few years ago as well, which hurt the poor and lots of Muslim majority areas as well. So this kind of digitizing of the economy into the future, you're potentially leaving behind millions of Muslims and other citizens as well. But it's particularly hitting the Muslim population, and they might not be able to access basic services within their own country.
Yeah, so it's kind of the two laws working together at the same time has created this sense of crisis among Indian Muslims, which has sparked nationwide protests, essentially.
And people are worried as well because Modi is more of a unashamed Hindu nationalist.
Yeah.
That it's emboldening the Hindu population to be more sort of aggressive and assertive and be more nationalistic and anti-Muslim in their political views. So he's kind of galvanized this prejudice and it's heightening ethnic tensions because it's a scene of, I guess, a tactic of divide and rule, right?
Yeah.
But he's got the numbers. He was in the election again last year. He got an even bigger majority in the elections again, so he is in a really powerful position.
And there's been a long-running issue. Over the last few years, there's been a dramatic upsurge in lynch mobs in rural communities attacking Muslims, often spread through conspiracy theories spread over WhatsApp. And the government has essentially been turning a blind eye to these all across the country and not been prosecuting any of these. And similarly with the anti-Muslim ethnic violence in Delhi at the moment, the Delhi police force is controlled by the federal government rather than the Delhi government. And the Delhi government sort of pointing at the government and saying, what are you doing? Why is there not more police on the streets? Why are they not stepping in?
And looking internationally now, so Trump was over to visit this week, and those two get along quite well. As you can imagine, they're both strong men with dodgy pasts, but they've overcome, and they're using sort of nativist, nationalist ideas to galvanize their base. And they both want to combat China and China's influence.
Yeah, it's funny. I was reading several analyses of what they hope to get out of it, and a lot of analysts seem to be sort of throwing up their hands and being sort of, neither of them really particularly seem to want anything especially, but... But yeah, no, the big one is that both of them are not massive fans of China. And China is becoming increasingly assertive in the South China Sea, spreading its influence across the region with the Belt and Road Initiative, which is putting an awful lot of Asia and Africa in the country's debt.
Yeah, so they're expanding their sphere of influence. And I think sometimes I used to forget that, you know, China and India actually have a border, and they are the two big superpowers of Asia.
And have a long-running border dispute
as
well.
Yeah, so... Yeah, there is a history of bad blood there, and then China, economically speaking, have been way more successful than India over the last few decades. India was meant to be the sort of surging through in the 21st century, but actually their predicted growth hasn't been what it was hyped up to be.
Yeah,
there's a lot of significant problems in their
still
economy.
Very high unemployment.
Yeah, so India got to be very wary of China's influence there. They're very much losing that geopolitical battle.
And this actually goes back to the new law on refugees. Because India, unlike the vast majority of the world, is not a party to the 1951 Convention on Refugees, which means historically it's not given legal status to the vast majority of people who have claimed asylum within India's borders. The only two exceptions to that have been refugees from Sri Lanka and from Tibet, which relates to the long-running tensions between China and India, because that's generally a way of sort of antagonizing the other partner if you accept
right.
flow of refugees from them.
Okay, so, I mean, looking forward, it kind of looks like this kind of violence and nationalism and aggression, you know, is working for Modi. It's not necessarily... You said it's a big problem for this government, but some might argue that actually it's sort of part of the plan to divide and cause greater tensions. A bit more chaos allows him to extend his powers.
This is going to seem like a very abrupt pivot, but this is, of course, what a lot of people worry about with Trump winning a second term, is that because Modi has always been a Hindu nationalist, but in his first term he was fairly restrained, shall we say. There were obviously a lot of black splotches on his record, but it wasn't too bad. Whereas, you know, sort of immediately after winning the election in 2019, he put the entire region of Kashmir into lockdown, which it still is and has been for months now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's been a dramatic upscale of the culture war, of the rhetoric, of the anti-Muslim policies being implemented. So it's like the second more thumping majority has really emboldened him to go full down that line, which is tends to be the pattern for sort of authoritarian nationalist leaders, but they'll wait until their second election victory before they're really, you know, until they've properly consolidated power before they really start implementing their full agenda. So God knows what the second Trump term holds in store.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it won't happen.
Indeed.
Okay, so we take a look at the lesser known stories from around the world.
Yep.
First, I'm going to take you to Cameroon.
Woo.
So some good news from Cameroon, really. But it's only good because it was very, very bad news beforehand. So back in October 2018, they had an election.
Mm-hmm. A while back.
Yes. Yes, yes. I'm starting at the beginning. They had an election and it was officially won by the incumbent party there, who had ruled for decades and decades. But the main opposition party, headed up by a man called Professor Kamto, as he goes by the Professor moniker, he claimed that he had won the election and that it was stolen from him, rigged, etc., etc. He then led mass protests around the country. He was the head of opposition, and he got arrested for unlawful assembly and, you know, contesting a legal, quote marks, legal election.
Sure.
And he was sent to jail for 9 months. But he, after that 9-month sentence, he then has been on a tour around Europe speaking. And now this week, he has finally returned to Cameroon for the first time since being released from prison, to great applause. Many of his fans are there, and hopefully, you know, he's hoping to spearhead a democratic movement back in Cameroon.
So one side saying it was a, you know, fair election, the other side saying it wasn't. Who's right?
I haven't done the electoral, you know, studies myself.
Stick with both sidesism for now.
You know, it's an African state with an entrenched regime, the Yaoundé regime. They've been in power for decades. The suggestion of election fixing, it's not hard to believe, is it? But then, you know, who knows?
Sure. All right. Now, I think we will head across Africa to South Sudan, where rival leaders have formed a transitional coalition government. South Sudan has sort of been in civil war, sort of intermittent civil war, since 2011, when they first declared independence. Salva Kiir has been declared president and Riek Machar has been sworn in as his deputy. They were in the same roles when South Sudan initially became independent, but the leader accused the deputy of attempting a coup in 2013, and since then they've led separate sides in a civil war that's been sort of bubbling ever since.
Mm.
Anyway, so a peace deal was signed in 2018, but this is the first time since then that the two sides have managed to negotiate a coalition government. So let's hope they can keep it together.
So a positive step.
Yeah.
For, I believe they're still the world's youngest nation.
I think so, yeah.
That's good. They're still, you know, they're still learning. Still getting there.
Yeah.
So that's very patronising.
But, you know, it's suffering from a major economic crisis. Half the population is dependent on food aid to survive.
Mm.
And there's rampant inflation. And it remains to be seen whether all of their many militias will be able to unite into a single army. Oh, and as well as all of that, there's also a swarm of locusts afflicting the whole of East Africa.
Yes. I remember I pitched that as one of our lighter stories one week, when actually it was a horrific natural disaster, essentially. So we didn't do that in the end. So, the pictures are horrifying. If we could refer you to the visual for this radio show.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's also a good segment on the BBC's From Our Own Correspondent podcast.
Ah, okay.
On Saturday, so I can recommend that.
Great. Well, bringing us more north, we're going into Europe, and we're going to probably one of the lesser talked about countries in Europe. Who am I going to say? Slovakia. When's the last time you heard of some Slovakia news, Alex?
Oh, I can't recall.
Well, exactly. So they are having their elections on Saturday.
Good
for them. Auspicious day, February 29th. Good choice. But they have a far-right surge. You know, typical pattern for Europe and around the world at the moment. But what's more interesting about this is incumbent Social Democratic Party, centre-left party, have been in power for the last term and were one of the major, been one of the major parties for since their independence in the 90s. A journalist was murdered in 2018 in Slovakia, and his murder kind of...
Oh, I remember, yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of murkiness around the investigation, and that's kind of exposed the Slovakian state and the establishment as quite a... kleptocratic and just kind of crony, you know, just a your bog standard corrupt state.
Yeah.
And that shone a lot of light on that. And people, then the main theme of this election now is law and justice and independent judiciary and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So the incumbent party, Social Democrats, have fallen way, way down in the polls. They're still leading, but they have less than 20% now. And there is a anti-establishment far-right, according to the Quartz website, a neo-fascist. But it's led by Marian Kotleba, and it's the People's Party, R Slovakia, so a very populist party.
Yeah.
They've surged up to 12%, and they're the second largest party in polling at the moment.
Thanks.
So we'll see how many seats they get in their 150-seat legislature. But fingers crossed, not too many.
And are the Social Democrats the same government that was in party at the time of the protests starting with the murdered journalist?
Yes, yes. So, yeah, they've borne the brunt of that anger.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to skip over to Thailand, I think, where the Constitutional Court ruled on Friday to dissolve one of the country's main opposition parties, the Future Forward Party. And the court's also banned 16 of the party's leaders from politics for 10 years. Party and its leader were accused of breaking election finance laws due to the leader loaning his party around $6 million during a campaign last year. And leader has, Thanathorn, has admitted to the loan, but argues that it was actually legal under Thai law.
Mm.
And there's a lot of legal experts arguing that he is correct. Not the first time that the Constitutional Court has done this to a party that is causing some trouble. In 2014, the Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra was removed from office in the midst of a political crisis following a constitutional court decision finding her guilty of abuse of power. And then only a few weeks later, there was a military coup and she was forced to flee.
Yes, and as I understand it, the military are still in charge.
Yes, more or less. It's debatable how much the democratic leaders are ever really in charge in Thailand, given if you are... anti-military, the Constitutional Court seems to mysteriously rule that you have broken laws.
Yes.
And this this most recent ruling is the 28th legal challenge that the Future Forward Party has faced over the last few years.
Wow.
And it's only been established for 2 years.
Mm. The military there, they keep promising democratic elections,
yes,
don't they, in Thailand, but they keep postponing them for reasons or one reason or another.
They're busy. Troublesome things.
Mm. My turn to be lazy this week. I only did two. Alex, where are you taking us now?
Well, now we're heading back to Africa. Three African stories this week. Where the Egyptian government is sending mixed messages regarding how much it wants to welcome Jews back to Egypt. Egypt used to have a fairly large Jewish community. About 80,000 used to live there, but few of those now remain. But the government at the moment has been making fairly friendly noises. It's invited back Jews pushed out after Israel's invasion in 1956. It's listed a number of Jewish cemeteries as heritage sites all around the country, and it spent millions of dollars restoring an Alexandrian synagogue. And there was a big ceremony on February the 14th where 180 Jews originally from Alexandria who were now scattered all over the world came back to the synagogue to rededicate it. And there was a ceremony and lots of celebration, but also, quite mysteriously, the government seemed not to want to spread the word out about this event too much. Access was very limited. didn't seem to want to talk about it that much. And this follows a broader pattern where the Egyptian government declares Jewish sites as heritage sites, but then locks them off from the people and general population and keeps them as inaccessible as possible. So it's sort of in two minds about how it thinks about Judaism.
Interesting.
In modern Egyptian society.
And I suppose there must be a history of Jewish persecution in Egypt.
Yeah.
That's still... that's why so many left, and I suppose the few Jews that do live in Egypt now probably quite fearful of violence against them, or...?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's been long-range tensions with the entire Arab community with Israel over the past two decades, and as that's happened, there's been increasing persecution of Jews. But then over the last 10 years or so, that's been easing slightly. Egypt and Saudi Arabia have been taking a softer line towards Israel, because now the more pressing regional conflict is with Iran, who Israel is just as much not a fan of as Saudi Arabia and Egypt.
So the enemies of our enemies are our friends.
Exactly.
That kind of attitude. Yeah. Well, this global news, I think, leads us perfectly into our debate.
The most global topic of all.
We're going to talk about localism versus globalism.
Indeed.
Here we go. Well, it's 2020, and there's been a recognition, I think, that some of the biggest political issues are global issues, thinking particularly climate change. But is there too much of a conflict and a tension between global solutions to a problem like climate change and local problems, such as keeping local industries alive and local economies thriving? Alex, you're going to say there is.
Yes, so I am arguing for the motion. Local representative politics is incompatible with tackling climate change. So, Friends of the Earth, who campaign on climate change and all sorts of other environmental issues, have argued that most authorities are doing far too little to meet climate targets. Many are making decisions that will actually increase emissions. Bristol City Council has recently approved airport expansion, while at the same time painting itself as one of the greenest local authorities, and a host of councils are approving new road schemes. Local councils love to declare climate crises, but few do pretty much anything about it. And virtue signalling is not going to solve climate change. Dozens of councils are set to miss the net zero target for 2050. We've known climate change is an issue for decades now, but local authorities have shown themselves to be beholden to special interests and short-term local concerns. They haven't acted. It's time we strip them of their powers. Local authorities don't have a legal obligation to tackle climate change, but they do have many of the powers relating to transport, building of new homes, that are crucial towards shaping a comprehensive climate policy for the UK. Essentially, it's a collective problem, so it should be dealt with collectively, and we need a coordinated, integrated response across the country. Essentially, a Tory government is never going to restore cuts to local government, so they're not going to be able to tackle the climate crisis even if they wanted to. And local governments can't even run deficits, whereas national governments can. And it's ultimately going to be far cheaper if there is a centrally run climate plan tackling the whole country simultaneously than if we have local authorities working against one another in the sort of jigsaw map of different ways. It's just going to be ridiculous, you know? And yeah, essentially it's cold, hard cash that's required. Centralising the process will mean that voters will know who's accountable for climate policy rather than it being spread across a plethora of government institutions at different levels of government.
Okay, thank you, Alex. Well, I think you're painting a bit of a false choice here that we have. So I agree that obviously a centralised plan has to exist if, as a nation, we're going to reduce our emissions and boost green industries and all that kind of stuff. Obviously, it needs to come from central government, these plans. But how on earth could we implement said plans if you didn't have local expertise in local areas doing these solutions? I think the idea that central government always knows best is a bit foolish. And while some local areas may be against certain green industries coming in or, you know, losing their fossil fuel-based industries or things like that, that's going to be a battle whether you're in a local place or it's the national government saying that. So ultimately, that's why we have a national parliament made up of hundreds of local representatives. You're able to raise these issues, raise concerns for local communities, but overall, the majority of the nation's local representatives make rulings for a local area. The fact that local areas have an ability to sort of challenge and have a voice in challenging these is essential for people being connected to democracy. So I don't think it's incompatible. I think actually this kind of localism is essential for national politics to even work in the first place.
Well, I think, my friend, you're lacking a sense of urgency. There's no tone of panic in your voice. And ultimately, we need to panic. We need to be acting now, and we need to act fast. And local governments have shown no appetite in doing so. They've failed. It's time we take their powers away and give them to a branch of government that is prepared to act dramatically and drastically. And you say local governments have expertise, but they don't. The Green Alliance think tank says very, very few authorities have the technical or financial resources or otherwise to make the changes that they need.
But I can jump in quickly there. That's their current state. This doesn't have to be how they are.
What are you proposing? Like forcible
things could be
moving
done,
of experts out of London.
Things could be done with things could be done with correct funding.
Mm-hmm. So we pay the experts to move to Northumbria or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Sounds good. And then ultimately, there is a fundamental problem in your logic, which is that populations are extremely well concentrated in cities than they are in rural areas. But it's often the rural areas that have mines, that have, are going to be places generating an awful lot of carbon intensive industries. So whereas the majority of the population might want to push for a carbon neutral strategy, there will be an awful lot of councils covering an awful lot of areas in the UK, which are going to be dominated with people who are going to be supportive of these carbon industries. So the devolved nature of the UK government really means that a lot of these issues just aren't going to be tackled, because it's never going to be in the interests of a council to destroy an industry if half their local population is employed by that industry.
That's a really good point, Alex. I'm glad you raised that, because what is needed is a shift in incentives.
Uh-huh.
We do need... Central government can't just demand that these local areas turn away from industries that are key to their economy. Yeah, that's not how it works. And that's the importance of local politics, as I was saying, that they are stakeholders for that area. So if they need to change something, the government needs to change the incentives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is what central climate change policy can do, because it could offer financial incentives to get rid of a fossil fuel-based industry and incentivize building and employing a green industries. So that's the perfect way, where you have central government funding, but it is locally implemented, where a council knows what the specific local problems and issues are, and with the correct funding, they're able to implement it smoothly so that communities don't massively lose out. There's not just this blanket policy that wipes away things that are important for the community. A local authority, that's what it's good at, is able to balance the needs of the local community.
But there's so much more to having a job than just an economic livelihood, right? It's your way of life, it's your culture, it provides a sense of stability and an anchor into the community. And
exactly,
It's still, what I'm saying is, even if you introduce financial incentives, councils are still going to be unwilling to uproot entire industries, which is maybe what they need to do to tackle climate change, right? Because their communities are never going to vote them in, even if there's that financial support to help them retrain, to help them find new jobs, they're still not going to be happy with the local council implementing those policies.
But there is a growing understanding that stuff needs to be done to tackle climate change.
But not among everybody.
Well, I think it's growing. And I think it's in the majority. And I think as time goes on, that will only increase. And I think there will be a consensus amongst it.
I just worry that majority is formed because, there's an overwhelming majority of people in the cities who believe that. And then maybe in other regions, it's more divided.
It is more divided, and that's because their people, if their job is in mining, right, they have a specific interest to be sceptical of climate change, right? But
motivated reasoning.
Yeah, but as time goes on, that's just going to slowly become more of a fringe or less accepted element. And the key part is, if you do change the incentive and go, okay, well, we do need to close down this mine because it is doing X amount of damage to the environment, that cannot continue. But we're not just abandoning you. We're not just closing down the pits, right?
Yeah.
We're actually going to put something in place that has nicer working conditions, potentially, some benefits to it, like it could be a better salary or whatever.
Yeah.
And also it means that your grandkids will be able to not live underwater. Then I don't think that's not a particularly hard sell to anyone, even a skeptic.
I'm still doubtful, but I think we'll leave it there. And now to close off the episode, just a few lighter stories of the week. Murray, what have you got?
Okay, so we're starting with US presidential candidate Joe Biden. He's known for his gaffes. and missteps, and he's made another one this week. I'll keep it brief. Essentially, he claimed that he worked with a Chinese official to sort of secure the Paris Climate Agreement. And it turns out the official that he said he worked with on this actually died 19 years ago.
Ah, that's a bit of a problem.
So he's either misremembering which Chinese official he worked with.
To be fair, there were very long negotiations. Can't remember quite how long.
or he worked with this official on a different project a long, long time before that.
Yeah.
Or he just maybe is genuinely thinks he's meshed two memories together, as some people with, you know, older brains, older brains sometimes do. But it's one of those little things that I think chips away at the sort of competence aspect, which Biden is one of his key sort of selling points as the competent, experienced politician who gets things done. But actually, he's a bit of more of a bumbling, embarrassing grandpa now, I'd say.
But despite sliding in the polls, still favoured to win in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So we will see what effect that has on the race.
Super Tuesday coming up.
Looking forward to it.
I'm sure we'll talk about it next week.
Yeah. And France has set up a national bedbug hotline. It's a bit of a problem for France.
I thought this meant to be lighter stories, Alex. You just told me about an infestation.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but it's what I've got, so take it or leave it. they're having a problem. That's basically the story.
The opposite of Into the Weeds there.
Yep.
Just going to read the headline
yep.
on that one. Cool. Well, on that note, I guess we'll say goodbye.
Farewell.
Au revoir.
Adieu.
Don't let the bedbugs bite. France.
See you next week.
Bye.